solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
Technology's gotten better. Trends have accelerated. But in general, virtual leadership is much more challenging. One thing that interestingly did not change was our ramp model of virtual leader effectiveness. So in 2011, when we studied the profile of top performing virtual leaders, they did four things really well. They built relationships and trust. They fostered accountability. They motivated people and influenced people. And they used process and technology to support the team. But if you really looked at the top one third of the virtual leaders who were really rated like the most highly effective leaders, they were really balanced. So they didn't over-index on relationships. They didn't over-index on process. They were very attuned to the unique dynamics of a virtual setting. So you fast forward to the latest research, and we did other surveys, of course, in the most recent book, and the ramp model literally comes out with the same dimensions of a virtual leader effectiveness. So I thought that was fascinating.
Hello and welcome to the 77th Conversation at the Play to Potential podcast. I'm your host, Deepak Jayaraman, and this podcast is a labor of love for the long term, where I have conversations with leading practitioners, thinkers, authors, artists, sportsmen, and several other leading professionals from different domains to decode insights around three themes: leadership, transitions, and careers. When I'm not podcasting, I'm usually working with leaders as a trusted sounding board, helping leaders and organizations play to their unique potential. To know more about the advisory work I do, and what's in the podcast archives, please visit playtopotential.com. It's playtopotential.com. We have an exciting update at the podcast. Several listeners have told us that we should be sharing some of the nuggets from the archives, given we have 750 odd nuggets in the library and we continue to build on it. We've started doing that for the last couple of months through WhatsApp, where we share a couple of nuggets a week, one around the middle of the week and one over the weekend. And if you wish to receive these extracts, do note down the number +91 85914 52129. All you need to do is to add this number to your contacts and send a one-line message saying you're interested, and we'll add you to the list. I repeat, the number is +91 85914 52129. In this podcast conversation, we speak to Darlene DeRosa, a consultant with Spencer Stuart's Stamford office in the US, and the co-author of Leading at a Distance, that she has co-authored with her colleague Jim Citrin. Given COVID, I guess all of us have had to deal with several leadership issues over the last year plus. How do you recruit effectively? How do you onboard thoughtfully? How do you set culture? How do you think about apprenticeship? How do you communicate intent, and much, much more. Darlene has been studying this topic of remote work for more than a decade. And COVID in a way has brought a lot of her thinking and research into the forefront. In this episode, we also do something that's different. I speak to four of the consultants from Spencer Stuart's India office to get them to share a little bit of an India perspective on these matters. So along with Darlene, you will also hear from four of the colleagues from Spencer Stuart India. This includes Rohit Kale, who is a managing partner for Spencer Stuart in India, Ritu Kochhar, head of the financial services and boards practice in India and head of private equity practice in APAC, Atul Bhandari, who is a partner based in Delhi and leads the technology, media and telecom and services practice across APAC, and Atul also serves on the Spencer Stuart's global board of directors. We also have Sahiba Singh, who leads the leadership advisory practice for Spencer Stuart in India, focusing on the areas of leadership assessment and development, leadership team effectiveness, and organization culture advisory. Without further ado, let's dive into the conversation with Darlene DeRosa and her colleagues at Spencer Stuart India. Darlene, thank you so much for taking the time to appear on the Play to Potential podcast. Excited to be talking to you.
Likewise, Deepak. Thank you so much.
In the podcast, Darlene, we are curious about people's journeys and their arc of life, if you will. If we could start with your journey before we dive into the book that you've just published. You have a PhD in psychology from Temple University. Then you spent 8 years in large organizations. Then you set up your own consulting practice and you were there for about 12 years. And now you're back in a large organization at Spencer Stuart. So talk to us a little bit about how you've thought about, you know, being on your own, building your own enterprise versus leveraging the power of a large platform.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a topic that I'm actually really interested in. And when we talk to leaders and we coach leaders, it's interesting to hear their journey. But for me personally, I had been in larger companies for a while after graduate school and working with leaders, and I loved what I did. And I always felt like there was a part of me that wanted to build something that was my own, that was entrepreneurial. And actually, coincidentally, a lot of it came out of the research that I was doing at the time on virtual teams. So it really is aligned with the conversation that we're going to have today. But I wanted to build a practice helping organizations and their leaders be more effective at leading at a distance. And so that actually became a core solution in my consulting practice that we built. And we did this for 13 years. And of course, we did a number of other things, but it was a really fun time to do something entrepreneurial. And it was great.
And if I may, having said that, yes. Darlene, if I may come in here, what prompted you to start studying this even 10, 15 years back?
Yeah, great question. So I had always been really interested in two things, people and business. And especially how people collaborate and engage with one another. And so at one point, I thought I was going to get my PhD in clinical psychology. But then I thought, I really am interested in teams and the team dynamic. And so I actually purposely chose a graduate school with an advisor who was focused on building high-performing teams. And as I was looking at the data, and again, keep in mind, this is like a long time ago, this is more than a decade ago, there wasn't a lot out there in business about how does technology facilitate team dynamics. And while AT&T and big companies had been working virtually way back then, I mean, again, this was a long time ago, it was interesting, there wasn't a lot of data on that. And so I actually developed my master's and my PhD dissertation studying real virtual teams in large huge companies. And so I'd always been interested in that, even from the early days of grad school. And that really became a theme in my career, even though I didn't realize it at the time.
Got it. Got it. And how have you thought about, back to the earlier question, Darlene, large platform versus solo? Have you talked to us a little bit about how you've thought about that choice and how you've sort of leaned in one way or the other?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think like with anything in life, there's trade-offs, right? And so that's been something that's quite clear. But my journey at Spencer Stuart, even though it's only been about 18 months, has been truly phenomenal. And really the power of a platform, especially the one that we have at Spencer Stuart, I'm spending my time advising CEOs and boards, and as are my colleagues. And the platform that we have here has really enabled Jim and I, as we wrote this book, but in general, to really engage with key business leaders, CEOs, CHROs. We interviewed about over 100 CEOs and CHROs for the book alone. It provides you access to these business leaders that I certainly wouldn't have had if I had been out on my own. And the other real benefit of the platform is just great people to engage with. And so this book effort was a huge team of people, a huge virtual team who worked together. And clearly that's very different than when I had my own company and wrote the first book in 2011. So in summary, I think there's a bunch of trade-offs. And for me, it's really about your own personal journey and what you need at that moment and where you really get your purpose from.
And let's dive into the book, Leading at a Distance, Darlene. You know, you spoke about 100-odd CEOs and CXOs. Could you provide a little more color around the kind of research and the backing behind the book before we start discussing the insights from the book?
Absolutely. Yep, absolutely. So as I mentioned, we did about 100 interviews with CEOs and CHROs. And this really, Deepak, was to get stories, to get best practices and anecdotes. And we knew that this, by the way, we were doing this research during COVID. So we're doing this research during a global pandemic. But we thought we still could garner some amazing insights. And remember, this is when organizations, especially those organizations who weren't working virtually before, had to rapidly pivot and make this very significant change. And then in addition to the 100 or plus interviews that we did three surveys over the course of about 9 months. And so one survey was targeted towards CEOs because we were really interested in the CEO dynamic during this transition. And then we had two other surveys that were looking more about how are people coping? What are some of the challenges people are experiencing? How has productivity been impacted? So looking at general trends as people and organizations had to rapidly pivot to this virtual environment. And so what was interesting is that we did the research at three different points to really look and see if there were any significant differences. And also we had our earlier research to compare this to. So it was a true team effort that was really great, because I think what was helpful for Jim and I as we were writing the book is to use this data and not be as focused on the research and the statistics, but have a hands-on toolkit for leaders so that they have practical tools and strategies to navigate the virtual landscape.
More a practitioner's toolkit rather than a academician's, thesis.
Absolutely. Yep.
Got it. And you've been researching this for a decade plus, as you said. What's changed and what stayed the same when we think about leading at a distance?
Yeah, it was interesting. In 2011, we did a lot of research. We looked at best-in-class virtual teams and what differentiated the best virtual leaders. So we were really focused on what does good look like, and that was the focus of that first book. And so, probably not surprisingly, in general, regardless of this virtual dynamic, leadership is more complex than ever in a VUCA environment. And frankly, that makes virtual leadership even more challenging. So back in 2011, we knew that virtual leadership was harder. So that for leaders who struggle with coaching and team dynamics, they're really going to struggle in a virtual environment. And frankly, that hasn't changed. Technology's gotten better. Trends have accelerated. But in general, virtual leadership is much more challenging. One thing that interestingly did not change was our ramp model of virtual leader effectiveness. So in 2011, when we studied the profile of top performing virtual leaders, they did four things really well. They built relationships and trust. They fostered accountability. They motivated people and influenced people. And they used process and technology to support the team. But if you really looked at the top one third of the virtual leaders who were really rated like the most highly effective leaders, they were really balanced. So they didn't over-index on relationships. They didn't over-index on process. They were very attuned to the unique dynamics of a virtual setting. So you fast forward to the latest research, and we did other surveys, of course, in the most recent book, and the ramp model literally comes out with the same dimensions of a virtual leader effectiveness. So I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah, so the more things change, more things stay the same, right? At some level, fascinating. And let's talk about some of these in let's double click on some of these. Building relationships, right? In the book, you talk about starting a relationship in 3D and moving it to 2D as something that's easy, but starting something in two dimensions and staying 2D for a prolonged period of time is a challenge. Talk to us a little bit about what effective leaders do in building and sustaining relationships in a two-dimensional plane. Nuances exist?
Absolutely. I mean, and keep in mind, we're just coming out of a global pandemic and we're still not even fully out of it, right? So there's some nuance of how much of this is because people have literally been at home, not interacting with anyone outside of work. Now you've got people who are literally working from home with their kids, their pets, their elders. You know, it's a really complex environment. So keep in mind that some of this might be unique to the pandemic. But in general, being virtual too long, just like we saw in the pandemic, the number one thing that people missed was the social interaction, and they felt more isolated. And I think this point in time has caused people to realize that humans value connection with others. And as a result, leaders spend even more time building trust, getting to know people and investing in relationships. And really, it's not that you can't do that in a virtual setting, but leaders who are more effective are really purposeful and deliberate. One leader that I'm coaching actually blocks time in his calendar to do this. I mean, that's how planful you have to be. Otherwise, you get busy and distracted, and you're not as focused on engaging with the team, but perhaps more importantly, making sure that your team members are engaging with one another's. And so I've seen really great examples of leaders step up and check in with people just with no agenda, which at first might seem a little strange if you haven't had that type of relationship with your manager. But just simply calling someone to say, hey, I was just thinking about you, would love to know how you're doing, and is there anything I can do to support you? That's a great example of one CHRO that we interviewed who makes what he calls care calls. Mm-hmm. Just to check in on people. Dedicating time in your day, putting it in your calendar to check in with your key customers or stakeholders, having a virtual coffee chat or a lunch. So again, it's simple things, but these things might occur more naturally if you happen to run into someone in a hallway in the office. But in a virtual setting, people get so busy that they're not as purposeful about building time for the relationship element.
Sahiba Singh, who heads the leadership advisory practice for Spencer Stuart in India, has an interesting example of a CEO she's working with who creates a safe space for his team members to attend to any important issue outside of the realm of work.
So communication increasingly is actually about not only what you're saying, but what you're not saying, what's happening in the background. So when you're talking to leaders and their children walk into the room or their pets walk in and they're okay with it, they're also sending a message that it's okay for the others, that there is a life beyond work that's playing out behind our Zoom backgrounds. So that's one aspect. I think the other is, I remember a story when the second wave had hit and most of us had family and friends who were impacted, and it was a really difficult time. There was a CEO who I was working with who would start every meeting by saying to whoever was on that call that if anybody needs to drop off this call to take care of their families, or if they're feeling just very sort of emotionally or mentally burdened with what's going on, they're free to drop off the call. We'll cover for them, no questions asked. And I thought that was really powerful because you were communicating your intent very well through that as well.
She goes on to talk about another leader who shows empathy towards people in the ecosystem, not just caring for the people within the company.
I think the other thing that I found was that during the time, again, during the second wave, I was working with a few clients who were in the logistics space or healthcare space, and we would get on to calls, obviously, to discuss business topics, and they would start these discussions by offering any help that, you know, I or our families or our teams needed. You know, in order to get vaccinated, to get access to hospitals, healthcare, whatever that might be, in whichever way their businesses could help. And I think it was really powerful because these, you think of these as moments that matter and they stay with you in terms of the special things that, you know, people have done. And that really makes an impression as well.
Now, let's get back to Darlene DeRosa. It's a great point. And one of the themes I've been hearing with the leaders I've been working with is they're saying that the current environment is quite efficient, but I'm not sure if it's effective. And you need to be really deliberate to make it effective and not just efficient. So how have you seen this whole efficiency versus effectiveness play out in a remote working context?
Yeah, it's a great question. And interestingly, I mean, I'm not speaking for every business and every industry. Certainly some industries were hit particularly hard during this crisis. But in general, if you look at our research and just the plethora of research that's out there, Deepak, it's clear people feel like productivity and efficiency is up, even despite the economy last year. But it's interesting, there's so much more burnout. So sometimes I believe the productivity is just because people are working longer hours and are working differently. And it's masking what we sometimes say is extreme burnout and fatigue. And that's something we experience at Spencer Stuart. We're really busy. And I think that's just a byproduct of people trying to adjust during a crisis where you're stuck at home. And now you perhaps are worried about your job. So you're working even more. We can't go anywhere. So we're working nights. If our kids are home, we have more things to deal with during the day, so we're working different hours to offset that. So I think in general, not all CEOs, but many CEOs have seen an increase in productivity and efficiency, but it's a complex situation. It's not one size fits all. And certainly that this is not true for every organization.
And going back to the competencies of a good virtual leader, the other piece you spoke about was how you drive accountability. What have you learned about what it takes to drive accountability in a remote context? And the reason I ask is, it's a fine line between giving people the space to perform, given their context, at the same time having a tab over what they're up to and whether you as an organization or they are on track on the deliverables. So how have you seen effective leaders walk that tightrope?
Yeah. And for leaders who are used to walking around and checking in on people or having really clear metrics or being in the office to make sure that people are working, this has been a significant mindset shift for some leaders. Now, for other leaders, this has been totally normative and they don't feel like they need that hands-on management. So one thing we're often coaching people and talking to leaders about is you've got, again, it's about being deliberate. You've got to be more clear about expectations because in a virtual environment, it's harder to set clear expectations. And perhaps more importantly, priorities shift. So how do you as a leader continually check in with people to make sure that they have clear direction? But one thing that we often talk to leaders about is called the ATC model.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really simple, by the way. So people intuitively understand this. But what we see time and time again is they don't follow it. And I think why it resonates, Deepak, is because we say that it's an acronym for air traffic controller. So just like an air traffic controller managing a lot of flights, you as a leader have to help people manage their priorities, their workloads, and you can't really see them. So you don't need to know what they're doing or when they're doing it. You just need to look at the output. That's mm-hmm. much more important in a virtual setting than when people work. So the ATC model is simple. It's action, timetable, checkpoints. And the checkpoints, it gets to your direct question about if you're very clear with people about when you can check in to support them or what they would like you to do in terms of the check-ins, then you're not going to be perceived as a micromanager. But if I'm randomly emailing you or pinging you on Teams to check in, people might feel like that's pressure. But if I said to you, Deepak, all right, so you've got this project. When do you think it would make sense for us to have a touch point? You said to me 2 weeks. And I said, great. And then we have a touch point. It's not going to feel like, hey, I'm checking in with you all the time. So again, it's really simple. It's not like this is some profound model, but we see leaders micromanage all the time. And they're emailing people, they're sending texts, and they're really not following that balance between delegating and empowering and micromanaging. And then lastly, I would say that you've got to adapt your style. One size fits all is not going to be an approach here. If you've got a highly tenured employee who's really capable, you probably don't need to check in as often. And that's why it's important to have a coaching conversation with the individual to say, how can I support you? So that style, flexibility, and situational leadership matters more than ever.
Got it. It's interesting. I was one of the leaders I was interacting with, a pretty senior leader in Uber. He had an interesting signature. It said, I've sent this email because it's convenient for me to send it out over a weekend or late at night, but I don't expect you to respond immediately. Take your time and respond, just as a part of the default signature. And I thought just such a small thing to do, but it can be liberating if you had an email with that. It just sort of takes the pressure away from responding to it if you got that email at, let's say, 5 a.m. Because that leader might be a morning person and you might have a different rhythm. So it just felt like a very interesting micro change, but something that can change the way people see you as a leader.
Yeah, and I think those micro changes, that's a great point, are actually much more important in a virtual setting because people don't have the cues to really read nuances. So things that might be perceived as urgent, are going to be perceived as maybe extra urgent. And so leaders have to role model the right behavior. And I think that Uber example is a great example. Another CEO who we were talking to was telling us that he was going to request that employees come in 2 days a week, starting in September. And then he said, and that's what I'll, recommend to the management team, but I'm going to be in 5 days a week. And we said, so-and-so CEO, do you realize that that's going to set unintended consequences? And so it's the role modeling of behavior and anticipating possible consequences of things like sending a text at 5 a.m. or an email. And so you really have to be more thoughtful and planful about how you engage with people.
Picking up on one of the things you said, Darlene, about how we communicate context or cues in a remote setting, what have you seen some of the interesting things that leaders do to ensure that the communication is packaged with cues and context, both in the way it's sent and the way it's read?
Yeah, I think that this is an area people are struggling with. I think in the very beginning of the pandemic, you know, people were really worried about their employees. So they're checking in, they're having these big town halls, they're doing surveys, they're gathering a lot of data. And I think many organizations over-indexed on, let's have a lot of virtual happy hours and too many meetings. And it was just like, let's just give you, we're trying to be communicative, but we went overboard and we're actually creating more stress and anxiety in the system when people are already busy. So that was one thing we saw early on. I think now we've seen a bigger shift that people have gotten used to the virtual setting and realize that your tone in an email or a text might be misconstrued. So I have seen many good examples of leaders being more thoughtful, even things like if your status on instant messaging is red, meaning you're in a meeting, don't ping someone just because you have a sense of urgency and need to do that. Send an email or have a delayed send on your email. Be rereading things. Don't send an email if it might have any significant news in it or anything that might lead to conflict or feedback in emails. I used to see really bad examples of this where leaders would actually try to coach people through email. And you and I might say, well, that's just ineffective. But I believe that a lot of the communications get distorted with technology and have what we call a neutrality bias. So if you think the intent of your message is positive, it might be perceived as neutral. If you think it's neutral, it's more likely to be perceived as negative. And so best-in-class leaders are very thoughtful with their communication, are picking up the phone when it's a more sensitive issue, having calls or video chats with people. Those types of things are really important to help detect cues.
And I guess there are two choices, right? One is the communication synchronous or asynchronous? And second is it just text or is it layered with voice and visuals? So I guess leaders have an opportunity to make the choice on both fronts to transmit cues.
Absolutely. And what we say is match your technology to the task. So for things that are complex, like coaching, conflict management, and even some types of brainstorming, doing that on a very synchronous tool like video conferencing is going to be the richest, like face-to-face, right? It's the closest to face-to-face that we have right now for most of us. Using things like email just to summarize your points and having a meeting where you need a dialogue and you need people to actually make decisions and problem solve. Don't bring people together just to have a meeting. So I think, again, what we saw early on, and you may have seen Microsoft's big article recently, they did a huge analysis of technology over the last year. Mm-hmm. Meetings have gone up, you know, and the percentage increase in meetings is ridiculous. The use of instant messages is way up. And what they basically concluded is people aren't using technology effectively, and they're not necessarily being thoughtful about their audience, like you were saying earlier with the Uber example. So there's so much information and digital overload and fatigue right now that leaders have to be much more cognizant of when and how to interact using some of these technologies.
And you actually, in the book, talk about your conversation with Jeff Tepper from Microsoft, the leader of the Teams communication platform. And you talk about the rhythm of a business and ensuring that the meetings are in line with the rhythm. Can you say a little more about the nuance here in terms of what you've observed about how organizations should think about cadence and their meeting schedules?
Yeah, and it goes a little bit back to what you were saying, Deepak, about the Uber example. So looking at how business gets done and not just doing something because it's convenient for you. So if I want to send an email at 5 a.m. because I need to get it off my plate and I'll feel better, that's probably not going to be really helpful or a great role model for people when I'm telling them to have some work-life balance. So you've got to really look at the way that the organization works, what's the cadence, making sure that people are not feeling like they're overloaded with information. And there's just so many technologies right now. It's not about having some glamorous technology. It's really comes down to using technology well. And so what Jeff talked about in relation to that rhythm of business comment that he made in the book, it's like you've got to look at your team, look at decisions that have to be made, the flow of information, and then match the technology to the task, making sure that the team is on board with how to use technology and tools, and also then periodically reevaluating that over time as your business evolves.
Hmm. And moving topics, Darlene, you, in the book you refer to Charles Handy, who says that the office of the future will resemble more of a clubhouse, a place for meeting, greeting, and eating, and rooms reserved for activities and not for people. What are you seeing around how organizations are thinking about getting back into a world of hybrid work, online and offline?
Yeah. And by the way, that's one of my favorite quotes. That was actually in my book in 2011.
Wow.
Because I was very fascinated by Charles Handy's research, which really originated on building trust digitally. So I was really fascinated with that for a long time. And I think, frankly, Deepak, that is more true now than when I wrote the first book in 2011. And it's interesting, what we conclusively know, and you've probably seen this in other research, is that the hybrid model is here to stay. So, you know, you may have some organizations who are much more office-centric, especially with an apprenticeship model, and they're going to really expect people to come back more fully. In the middle, you've got this hybrid model where you've got some people in and some people with flexible arrangements and maybe a blend of both. And then on the other end of the continuum, you have organizations who are a bit more progressive who are saying, you know what, you can work virtually for at least, you know, some period of time or forever. And that degree of flexibility varies tremendously. What we do know, at least as of right now, looking at the data from different companies, is that about 75% of companies are going to fall in the middle. So you might have some outliers, but in general, many organizations are thinking about how do I lead and manage in a hybrid model, which is the most difficult model to manage in because it presents challenges around equity and fairness. And so what we clearly know is that it's not a one-size-fits-all approach, but there's implications for companies who try to go back to normal. Because as Handy said...
And when you say equity and fairness, what do you have in mind, Dali?
Well, what we know from other research is that there's different power dynamics. If you're one of the individuals who's always in the office, let's say, with your manager, you might have more access to projects, you might get promoted more. It's the idea that if you're out of sight and you're virtual, you might be out of mind.
Got it.
Or things like if you are not at the conference table in a meeting and you're in your home office, how is that an even playing field? So there's a whole, I mean, this is like, or every conversation I have right now with CEOs and CHROs is about this equity. It's a huge hot topic right now. But the one point I did want to make is that companies who really try to go back to the way that they were are going to have issues from a talent perspective. You know, because most people want a higher degree of flexibility than ever before. And we're seeing companies be much more thoughtful about the role of the office. So Charles Handy even said, you know, what's the role of the office? At Spencer Stuart, we're talking about the power of place. We want our offices to be places where people come to collaborate, perhaps to coach, and to connect with one another. But it's not going to look like it did pre-pandemic, at least for us. And that's the case for most organizations. So how do you create an office that excites people, where people want to go? So a lot of clients are rethinking their real estate footprint commercially and are hoteling and rearranging the offices to foster collaboration and create the space that allows people to interact with one another. And they're even doing things like rethinking what amenities they offer, having more outdoor space, having more space for people to meditate. I mean, all types of things. And we're really seeing a big shift in this, Deepak. So it's quite interesting.
And any interesting experiments on the edge that you see, Darlene, given people are slowly beginning to come back?
I think I don't know if it's an experiment, but I mean, we have seen a number of examples, and these are in the press, about organizations being too specific, too early on about what's going to happen. And I don't know if you saw the McKinsey article that talked about communication is more important right now because there's a high degree of anxiety and fatigue in the workforce. And we know people want more flexibility, at least in some form. So even if you don't, as a company, you don't know what's going to happen, it's better to say that and be authentic and genuine than to say, we want everyone back in September. And then say in September, okay, we're going to have to pivot and do this. People, that is causing extreme anxiety. And so there's, I've seen some tremendously great examples of how to message this and say, we don't know exactly where we're going to go, but here's what we're thinking. The office is going to look different. Work is going to look different. And we know we're going to offer more flexibility. We're in this together. We're trying to figure out what that's going to look like. And we're going to get your point of view and see what you think. And we're going to shape this together versus some companies who are very publicly saying, we're all coming back. This is the way it's going to be. And they may have issues from a talent retention standpoint. So I think these are really important considerations. And my advice would be, don't put a stake in the ground too soon, because you may not have all the answers. And we don't know necessarily what's going to happen in the next, 9 to 12 months.
And that's okay, right? That's the point you're making. It's okay to be vulnerable to say, we're still figuring it out. There are enough unknown unknowns, and being authentic and vulnerable probably trumps a sense of misplaced confidence is the point you're making.
That's exactly right. A much better way to say it than I did, but that's exactly right. And I would add, the companies who are doing it better are taking a pulse and really checking in with their employees. Because as you know, Deepak, this is a change management strategy as well. You've got to get buy-in for the change. And so I think for many organizations, they're just sort of making the decision and saying, this is what we're going to do. And many other organizations are being much more thoughtful and really thinking about, how do we build culture? How do we keep people engaged? How do we take a pulse and see how people are feeling over the next 12 months?
In the book, you also refer to Yanbing Li, VP of Engineering at Google Cloud, who first said, with this pandemic, we are all in the same storm, but possibly in different boats. And that quote really struck me. It sort of captures the diversity of experiences people have around this pandemic. What's that meant in terms of leadership, especially in a remote context? How do we lead when people are in different boats?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I do love that quote. I think now more than ever, again, leadership is more complex than ever, but we have seen tremendous examples of leaders step up and demonstrate vulnerability and authenticity, great levels of transparency. And now the bar has really been elevated. In our CEO practice, our CEO profiles are, there's so much in there that boards want now, right? The whatever we used to think about in terms of capabilities, now there's all these other things. The leadership side has taken on even greater importance. And so we've seen really great examples of leaders actually slowing down and taking time to learn about their team members. Maybe, they don't have a home office, or they've got their kids at home, really connecting with people in a more authentic way and engaging with empathy. Some great examples. One chief commercial officer at a global pharma company encourages his team to just get out from behind their computers when he wants to talk to them and say, let's go on a walk together and let's have a coaching chat. So really engaging with people on issues that extend beyond work because of COVID and all the other things that people have been dealing with over the last 16 months. So I've seen some awesome examples of leaders truly stepping up. And frankly, now there's an expectation that's been set. And so it's going to be hard to go back to anything else.
And you briefly alluded to boards. I'm also curious about how this remote work has impacted boards in terms of how they meet, the kinds of issues they discuss, the way they come to a judgment, and just the whole dynamic. Any headline observations at a board level?
Yeah, I mean, and Jim, my co-author who runs our CEO succession practice, has some awesome stories. I mean, he recruited the CEO of eBay during the crisis, and the board never met the candidate. So wow. I think, Spencer Stewart and other companies are working with boards, and I think boards have actually adapted and realizes not for every single board. We don't necessarily need to fly everyone together as often. We can do some things virtually, and we can actually be quite productive. I do think right now we are seeing a resurgence of corporate governance and refocusing on CEO succession now that we've gotten through the pandemic. CEO succession during crisis tends to be flat because most boards are not really going to disrupt anything. But we are starting to see a bigger trend towards boards actually really coming back and revisiting their future corporate governance strategy. But we have seen some really good examples of boards who made these transitions to the virtual structure very simply.
Got it.
For this piece, I also spoke to Atul Bhandari, who's a partner based in Spencer Stuart's Delhi office and leads the technology, media, telecommunications and services practice across Asia Pacific. Atul also serves on Spencer Stuart's global board of directors. I spoke to him about how the board agenda has evolved over the last 15 odd months since COVID struck.
In terms of the agenda items, I thought, as I said, it started out more with, okay, how do you continue to maintain operations given all the external things and factors that were going on, the fact that people were not in office, we had to equip them, to work from home, etc. From there, I think as the intensity of the pandemic increased, it really shifted to understanding, you know, what's the impact on people, their health, their lives, their families, and really taking care of people became the critical focus area. From there on, I think it's evolved over the last 6 months. There are certain permanent shifts that are happening, which have impacted business models and operating models pretty much across industries. So for example, the role of technology has probably been one of those things. I think the pandemic has supercharged technology adoption across all aspects of business, unlike any other event that we know of. The whole sudden shift to work from home meant that everyone had to be enabled. The fact that you could not use traditional ways of reaching your customers meant that overnight, everyone had to think about digital-focused business models. Again, lots of initial challenges. Many companies struggled. Likewise, we did as well. And especially in India, the teams were, the fact that we do not have environments at our home that are conducive to work from home. And all of a sudden, within a few weeks, it just took a few weeks and most businesses adapted well within the context of their operating models. And now boards are encouraging companies and leadership teams to continue to embrace technology across the entire value chain. So whether it is, we can use all the fancy terms, industry 4.0, digital transformation, et cetera, the reality is that the way technology has become an important agenda item on the board agenda is very interesting. At the same time, the whole focus on sustainability, value creation, that has not changed. In fact, if anything, I think as boards, we must now step up. We need to ensure that we reinvent our organizations for this new normal.
Ritu Kochhar, who heads the financial services and boards practice in India and is the head of private equity across Asia Pacific, she spoke about how boards have started focusing much more on ESG and on risk mitigation across the various elements of the business.
You haven't necessarily seen something completely different come up, at least from the larger traditional companies, which is a lot of sort of the subset that we're seeing. What there has been is maybe a shift in, say, the topics that they've been thinking. We didn't earlier, the talk around ESG, sustainability, how should they actually be thinking about the charter of a risk committee and what all it should actually be covering. And then the focus on just, how we actually thinking about crisis management. I can tell you, I was with a lot of the board evaluations that we were actually doing. One key area that used to come out is just, most places did not always have a crisis response plan in place. They would have one, but it wasn't fleshed out to the extent it should be, right? And you talked about some macro risk, you talked about industry risk, but you didn't see, a big crisis response plan across the board. And we saw a big shift in this particular case by a lot of boards, just thinking about it. And, I'm talking, this is across the board, whether it's manufacturing, IT services, or broader sort of, metal mining, across the board. That was one thing that had been a missing link. And we saw a lot more focus on making sure that is actually developed. Second, just reviewing the charters of sort of risk committee, which, making sure that the things that they hadn't necessarily thought about, right, earlier. And so the innovation you actually saw was more in, you know, when you highlighted some of these risks, how do you think about agenda? For example, supply chain.
Right.
You know, what is it? How does a company de-risk itself for that, from that? And it was not earlier thought about, because where this, it was not just the pandemic. This, to some extent, also came at a time when you were seeing a shift in global macro sort of politics, right? And you combine the two, a lot of global companies with sort of complex supply chains got impacted by this, and they hadn't necessarily thought of this double shift together. So that's where I think innovation was driven more, whether boards actually put this on the agenda, but it was actually driven more in companies.
While the board agenda has evolved in the last few months, I think the last several months have also led to a certain set of skill sets at the board level, which have become a lot more critical. Here, Atul speaks about this piece of insight.
If we look at the board spec, I think the whole extension of having people who understand technology, potential impact of technology on business models, the need for security, especially as business models become more and more digital and technology driven, is definitely one archetype of a board profile that is becoming increasingly sought after. The second archetype that again is becoming quite sought after is people who understand people deeply, understand what motivates employees, succession issues, how do you make sure that you have sustainable leadership teams. So, you know, the NRCs are being strengthened now with looking at people who have been CHROs in their past life. In fact, in many ways, the pandemic has brought the role of the CHRO to the front and center of the organization. And I believe that has continued at the board level. And I would say the third thing, partially driven by some of the global events, and something that was very high on every board agenda, is the whole notion of diversity, equity, and inclusiveness. So I would say from a spec perspective, those are the three big areas, with technology becoming the center of a lot of the future business models and operating models, and hence boards are increasingly looking at people with a deep orientation towards technology and how technology impacts business models and customer interactions.
The other piece that's evolved in the last few months is the way the boards have engaged with the management teams in companies.
Two things which we started seeing the boards actually also you know, do a lot more, which is communication with the management team. There's you know, examples in sort of, you know, in a few cases where we saw the boards actually also, you know, communicate not just with the CEO and the core sort of management team, but, you know, broader, being part of town halls as well in a few cases, because the frequency of communication, and that's where I think the innovation was probably more driven in, you know, the communication part of it than anything else to some extent. You know, how do you actually do town halls and have, you know, board members be involved, you know, facilitate a lot more interaction. I think that's why we're saying it was a lot in sort of the logistics piece of it. But over communication versus, you know, more controlled communication was the mantra, particularly early on. I think now you are seeing a little bit where people have become more comfortable in you know, just driving some of these, and it's become part of life. But initially, a lot of organizations, you know, some I should say struggled with it, and the others actually adapted to it fairly fast. And that's where the whole having a nimble, agile board, which earlier nobody would actually think of, also matters to some extent.
Now, let's get back to Darlene DeRosa.
And in the book, you also say that the virtual setting has negatively impacted the CEOs much more than the non-CEOs. I was reflecting on that insight, and I was wondering what some of the factors might be which might have led to this. Would you have some hypotheses around why the CEOs might be impacted more than the non-CEOs?
Yeah. I mean, I think Jim and I talk about this, and I think even just anecdotally in the interviews that we did, and this isn't true for every single CEO, certain industries clearly were hit harder in the pandemic, like hospitality and leisure, for example. So this isn't true across the board. But it was interesting. Most CEOs felt like the transition to virtual work and the benefits of it were quite good. But not surprisingly, work-life balance was much more disruptive for CEOs. And I think, by the way, I mean, we wouldn't say that you expect CEOs to have tremendous work-life balance. We wouldn't necessarily like feel badly. But by the same token, you know, you're leading during a global pandemic with a range of economic and political issues in the landscape. And I do think that this put even more of a burden on CEOs. So greater levels of burnout, even less work-life balance. And so examples of one CEO that we interviewed for the book talked about how many global town halls he had to do in the first 3 months of the crisis. I mean, it's just constant crisis management. And so I think that some of the data is probably attributed to this very difficult point in time. And then some of it is that, you know, again, CEOs are going to feel more pressure. So I wouldn't say that what we found is isolated to the virtual environment.
Got it. Moving on, Darlene, you know, some professions are based on apprenticeship, including search that I was a part of. And you're a part of a search firm and a leadership advisory firm. And that often requires physical proximity. I was curious, what are some of the trends you're seeing in terms of nurturing a culture of apprenticeship in these times?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, we definitely can relate to this at Spencer Stuart. In our own data, we had a power of place task force, and I was on that as we were going through the last 16 months. And that notion of apprenticeship definitely was something we saw very clearly in the feedback. And I think one of the things that we've started to do much more proactively, again, it comes back to being planful and thoughtful, is finding ways for people to have communities of practice. So let's say I'm in the healthcare practice. How am I having pods where I get to check in with my colleagues and we can learn and we put people on projects together to really, even in a virtual setting, you can have an apprenticeship model. You just have to be more thoughtful about it. So we've seen some organizations do things like create culture buddies where you can pair people up. It could be like peer mentoring, but it could be someone who's highly tenured with someone coming new, you know, newly into the organization, and making sure that they feel like they've got that apprenticeship structure. There's been a lot more of a focus on leadership development and mentoring, and a lot of organizations have pivoted and rethought their investments in training and have been doing that virtually. So again, this isn't new for many big companies, but for some companies, they didn't have these processes in place. So I think the other thing that we have been seeing is that companies have been much more focused on making sure their leaders have the coaching skills to be effective in a virtual setting, because we know that giving people feedback is one of the biggest items that drives employee engagement. So a lot of our clients from a leadership development perspective are focused on helping their leaders build a coaching skill in an apprenticeship culture. So again, it's not a simple fix, but I do think there's a number of things that companies have done and are doing to really try to replicate that apprenticeship culture.
I also got a chance to speak with Rohit Kale, who heads Spencer Stuart in India. He spoke about the impact of the remote working situation on a profession like executive search, where apprenticeship is a big part of the equation when it comes to development of colleagues.
Yeah, look, I think the apprenticeship and learning therefore has been impacted significantly. The fact is that if in a professional services context where apprenticeship is key, being able to be part of every discussion, being able to be part of discussions that you're not even technically invited to, for example, somebody sitting next to you and watching what they're going through, or being able to bounce off ideas with others, is a huge part of the apprenticeship process. I do think that has suffered. On the other hand, I have also seen an impact where, given that every client meeting is now an online meeting, we are seeing a lot more participation of our research team and our EA team in every progress review. Whereas earlier, many of these progress reviews would happen at client site, and as a result, would be only with the consultant and the client. And therefore, we are also seeing that the research group now has a lot more exposure to both business development meetings as well as progress reviews. So in some hands, we can see that the exposure has increased and that has helped apprenticeship. On the other hand, the peer learning aspect of it has been significantly impacted.
Now, let's get back to Darlene DeRosa.
And just picking up from one of the things you mentioned, Darlene, a leader transitioning in the first 90 days, 100 days, I'm assuming it's much harder in a remote context where you haven't met people, you haven't, as one of the professors, Sumantra Ghoshal, says, you haven't smelt the place. So you don't get a sense of the culture and how things get done. What have you seen about transitions in a remote context that we're seeing? Any headline insights around what leaders and organizations should bear in mind to make this effective?
Yeah, I mean, we've had to do a lot of this at Spencer Stuart, both in our search and the coaching practice that we're, you know, working in. But I think there's a number of interesting things that companies have done. As an example, one CEO said he literally would change his video background that sort of make it look like he was in the Switzerland office one day. And he got off to such a fast start because rather than taking 3 months to travel to every office, he could do the same thing in a month. And so he could have so many video meetings that were much more effective and one-on-one meetings, by the way, where he has bigger reach in terms of the employee population, plus a number of town halls, and said he'd never go back to the way he was doing it before. That's just one example of how, yes, it's harder and you've got to be more thoughtful, but there can be a lot of efficiency if you do it well. And so we've seen some really interesting examples of organizations who have done a nice job rethinking their onboarding strategy. So sending people care packages to help them understand the culture of the organization even before they join, and sending care packages. So it's not like you're just getting a laptop. You're getting things that help you understand and learn about the company. We've seen some organizations hiring and creating new roles to really think about onboarding and culture. And so we at Spencer Stuart, for example, have seen some clients create roles like head of remote work or head of culture, because this is really important from an onboarding perspective. Some organizations have created, as I mentioned earlier, culture buddies or onboarding liaisons that are helping guide people throughout the journey. And even things like cohort-based onboarding programs for mid to senior level leaders, so people feel connected from day one. So I think those are just a few of the things. Leaders who we coach who really are thoughtful about this and set up a series of one-on-one and group meetings to rapidly build trust and foster those relationships clearly are more effective than those who don't. So it comes back to, Deepak, that notion of being purposeful and being thoughtful, but we've seen some great examples of people onboarding virtually very successfully.
I discussed this piece with some of the colleagues from Spencer Stuart in India. Atul Bhandari spoke about how companies are assigning two kinds of mentors, formal and informal, and how we need to pick them differently.
That's a much harder one, Deepak, right? Because, you know, culture is all about how does the workplace function, right? It's the subtle nuances that you observe at the workplace, the way things get done. Now, how do you do that in the virtual world? It's much harder to replicate, to be very honest. I think what we have seen people do effectively is get people to meet a lot more people even before they join, right? So the onboarding process, which traditionally used to start once you formally join, now people are saying it's important for me to get to know who I'm going to be working with. So let's not wait till the individual formally joins. Let's actually start that. The other thing that we have observed is to, you know, assign both a formal and an informal mentor who can kind of be your, you know, one who you can talk to at 2 p.m. in the afternoon, the other who you can have a very candid conversation at 11 o'clock in the night about how you're feeling about things. So I think those are a few things that, you know, that companies have done. You cannot completely replace the physical element. Having said that, you know, we have seen lots of CEOs and CXOs on board over the last 12 months and done so effectively.
And maybe just picking up on the point about the 11 p.m. informal mentor, any perspectives around how to pick that?
A couple of things. I think one, it's somebody where, you know, either you build a very strong comfort level quickly, or typically somebody that you have known from your past life, who, you know, because it's got to be somebody that you trust and somebody that you're comfortable with, right? So those two are critical criteria. And again, it's not going to happen in each and every situation, Deepak, so we need to be cognizant of that.
Rohit Kale makes an interesting point here. He says that the interviewing process has become more elaborate these days, but that's also given more touch points for the candidate when he or she comes on board. So in a way, the widening of the interviewing pool is not only helping in decisioning, but also in integration.
I think one of the insights has been that the integration actually starts even before the hiring decision is made. What I mean by that is, given that most interviews are anyway Zoom interviews, remote interviews now, we are seeing the number of interviews that every candidate has to go through increasing exponentially. That allows, A, of course, it's part of risk mitigation in the hiring process, but more importantly, it actually allows that individual to get a far better sense of what the overall peer group in the office looks like. Start getting connects with the peer group at a much earlier level and brings the peer group into the decision-making process and therefore gets the alignment and therefore gets the buy-in from those individuals even before the hiring decision is made. That allows the hiring and, you know, just allows that there is a bigger group of people who now have a vested interest in making that individual successful because you've got the buy-in earlier.
Sahiba Singh speaks about how some companies are using this as an opportunity to be a little more deliberate and reflective about their culture.
So yeah, we are seeing this a lot. And what this situation has actually led people, led organizations to do more about is think about what their culture really is and how do they describe it to people who haven't had the opportunity to, as you say, smell the culture or learn by observations. So more than ever before, clients are thinking about how do we translate what our actual culture is into how things work on the ground. So telling new employees about how we run meetings, how decisions are taken, how we communicate, what do we do, what do we not do, and really thinking about their culture. And in that process, what's also happening is more clients, as they are articulating how things work today, they're also becoming more reflective about how things should work and what's wrong and how can they use this opportunity to actually fix it or change things that they've been wanting to change in their culture.
If you're curious about setting leaders up for success in a new environment, I would point you to three resources of the podcast. First is a conversation with Professor Michael Watkins, the author of The First 90 Days, often considered the Bible of transitions. Second is a conversation with R. Gopalakrishnan, veteran leader in the Tata Group and HUL, and the author of Crash, Lessons from Entry and Exit of CEOs, where he studied 15 high-profile CEO appointments that went south. Finally, I would point you to the curated playlist Settling into a New Context, which has wisdom from a variety of sources, including how Gandhiji thought about how settling into India after his stint in South Africa. For the two speakers, you can go to playtopotential.com and find Michael Watkins and R. Gopalakrishnan in the guest section. For the curated playlist, you could go to playtopotential.com, access the tab Curated Playlists, and within that you will find settling into a new context under the category of transitions. Let's now get back to the conversation with Darlene DeRosa. And picking up on one of the things you said, Darlene, one-on-ones versus town halls, do you see that mix shifting in the remote work context as compared to the physical work context?
You know, that's a good question. I'm not sure. I don't know if I've seen enough examples of that. We have seen more town halls in the last 16 months, but I think that could be because of COVID and trying to bring people together and foster community since people were not in an office. So it'll be interesting to see what happens, but we've definitely seen an increase in those larger group type meetings and really bringing people together because you can do that really efficiently when you're virtual.
Hmm. It has much less friction to organize these conversations across geographies and time zones.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think a lot of organizations have done that really well, like using technology with a purpose and trying to bring people together to both help them build a skill or to help them interact with one another. So using technology well, I think has been really some good examples of that versus companies who are just using technology without really thinking about like why they're bringing people together, just having a town hall for a town hall or having a town hall where maybe people have no forum to engage. So I've seen varying levels of success with this.
Got it. And moving to a different theme, leadership assessment, which in a way it's sort of meat and potatoes at firms like Egon Zehnder and Spencer Stuart. I was talking to one of my friends in the search industry, and he was saying that there's a certain kind of candidate who ends up presenting well in the online medium as compared to the real world. And therefore, it becomes even more important for us to ensure we don't get biased by how people present in an online medium. What have you observed about assessment and judging leadership capabilities in the remote context?
Yeah. And I think, well, in many ways, at least in the searches that we're doing, we're seeing a lot more of an interest in assessment, maybe for a slightly different reason. But to your point, I mean, people, whether you're virtual or not, people can interview well. And we've known this, right? And you know this from your time at Egon Zehnder. I mean, some people just interview better than others. So a lot of our clients are really rethinking their assessment approach to make sure that it's multidimensional. And because of those leadership traits that I talked about earlier being much more important right now to many organizations, especially boards who are recruiting CEOs and senior execs, wanting people who are authentic, who can engage people even despite the distance. There's a lot of those personal characteristics that boards are now really focused on, integrity. You know, those things have always been important, but they're more important than ever. And so a lot of boards and clients are using more multidimensional personality assessments and other types of assessments that go beyond just an interview, where people might be particularly skilled in an interview or presentation, and you might not be looking at the whole person. So that's something we've clearly seen.
Got it. Atul Bhandari of Spencer Stuart India speaks about how interviewing in a remote world requires you to dig into stories and context much more than you would otherwise. He also speaks about the criticality of referencing.
So, couple of things. One, it's very important to go deep into the stories that the candidates are telling us, right? And when I mean stories, it's about how have they created impact and in what environments they've created impact, right? Which is what we used to do earlier as well, by the way. Nothing's changed on that, right? But I think just going a level deeper, because you are not able to pick up some of those body language signals, has become very important. Secondly, I think the whole assessment has become a lot more multidimensional, moving away just from an interaction. And what do I mean by that? So there is a lot more focus on referencing today. In fact, not just us, but even clients are keen to do references directly. Because that is where, in the absence of meeting somebody physically, because typically in an interview process, you would meet somebody, you know, 5-6 times, you'd get multiple points of view, you know, everyone would pick up a different interesting nugget that they picked up, whether it was the eye contact, the body language. That's much harder to do on a screen. It's much harder to pick out some of those nuances when you are doing 10 to 12 Zoom meetings in a day, right? So that referencing has become extremely important.
Ritu Kochhar of Spencer Stuart India speaks about the opening up of the aperture of recruitment, given people could be productive from remote locations.
I think in general, if you ask me, when it comes to taking decisions around hiring, people also, most organizations, which is good, not all, but quite a few organizations have actually also started thinking about, you know, what future of work will look like in their organization. And I think that has opened up the thinking a bit. And I'm not just talking about, say, just the CXO level talent, but we are seeing, you know, organizations be a little bit more flexible. So, you know, you either have the work from home, or you have the hybrid model, or you have sort of, in some cases, so for example, for tech companies, so there is this, you know, financial services company which wanted to set up a core, you know, digital led sort of platform. And this is Mumbai based. Traditionally, they would have wanted everybody to sort of relocate to Mumbai, right? Here, they are hiring people from Bangalore, Hyderabad. They're so become so comfortable with that particular piece that, you know, they're happy to sort of have an organization which works very differently than what their traditional sort of financial services, you know, organization has actually looked like. So in some respects, it's actually opened up on how people think about some of these things in the new sort of dynamic workplace and working models as we're talking about it.
Rohit Kale speaks about how hiring from different areas is actually helping drive some of the diversity agenda these days.
We all know, you know, finding, for example, hiring financial services talent into non-Mumbai locations is difficult. Similarly, finding digital talent in Mumbai is difficult. And suddenly you're saying, well, they don't need to come to Mumbai. They can continue to be based in Bangalore. It suddenly opens up the vista for the kind of talent that you could potentially bring into your company.
He actually goes on to speak about how hiring in the remote world has led to people leaning more towards experience rather than potential.
Where you're hiring, for example, completely new, you know, somebody from a completely different sector or a function into a role, it is that much harder. The familiarity that people bring into the role kind of also has an impact on how successful that person is in a remote hiring and a remote integration scenario. And therefore, what we are seeing, and particularly the impact of the last, is actually something that I'm not very happy about, is because people are defaulting to experience versus potential. They just feel that much more comfortable that the person knows what they are talking about. We are not betting too much on the potential of the person, but we are hiring for what that person knows.
I guess this is possibly driven by the fact that the leader coming in has a shakier scaffolding to work with in the context of the transition. So focusing more on experience and potential is possibly a risk mitigation approach in these times. Let's now get back to Darlene DeRosa. In the book, you also talk about the notion of digital bonfires, and you refer to Discovery's David Zaslav, where he got experts from different parts of the world and got the organization together. At the same time, I hear there's a little bit of webinar fatigue that people are experiencing. So what have you seen about, once again, purposeful engagement and this concept of digital bonfires, if you could expand on that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I touched on this a little bit before, but I do think in the beginning, leaders were much more cognizant of trying to bring people together and did not always do it with the right focus or the right cadence. And in the beginning, I think a lot of people felt obligated, like, to attend a, you know, virtual event. So I think in the very beginning of the pandemic, companies, again, spent too much time on that. And now people are really realizing that that can have unintended consequences. So being much more thoughtful about bringing people together, again, that community of purpose, people who have similar goals, similar things that they might be working on, similar interests. So a lot more peer mentoring. We've seen a lot of organizations invest in guest speakers and education to keep developing people. Because right now there's been an actual surge in an interest in people's own development and growth. And one thing you can do pretty easily in a virtual environment is try to replicate that. So we've seen a lot of companies inviting guest speakers, having leadership panels, things that help people develop, but are not necessarily, they don't feel like it's mandatory and doesn't put an extra burden on people. So I think what's good is that we've now realized over time the right balance and cadence of how and when to bring people together. And to your point, it's got to be purposeful and it has to add value.
Got it. And just coming to how we manage our energy in these times, Darlene, you know, initially when we started remote work around the pandemic, you know, there was a sense of the fact that we weren't commuting, there was a lot of time released and we were able to spend time with family. So there was a little bit of a, if I may, mini celebration at the early part. But very quickly, I realized that, myself included, it's actually gotten more intense and more stressful and people are working harder. And the sense of fatigue in the system seems to be much higher than what it was maybe 15, 20 months back. What have you seen about leaders managing their energy in these times?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think we've seen a range of things. And we would agree, by the way, we saw that exact trend and the data suggests that. And Microsoft's study also suggests that these huge productivity numbers in many companies are masking that extreme burnout and fatigue. And so I think leaders, one thing we talk about a lot is in a virtual world, you have to really be your own CEO. You've got to manage your calendar. You've got to create balance. And if you're leading a team, as we've talked about earlier, you've got to role model that behavior. So if you're telling people don't work on a weekend, you shouldn't be firing off a ton of emails on the weekend. And you've probably read in the news, a bunch of organizations have actually been so focused on mental health and work-life balance that they've given people a week off, everybody in the company the same week, so that they don't feel pressure to work. I mean, there's not been like a ton of those examples, but those examples are actually quite profound of really encouraging people to have balance because people have worked so hard for so long. One leader that I'm coaching actually encourages his team every Friday to take a half day and just do something with their family or do something on their own. He also encourages them to block time in their calendar to get work done and has meeting-free days. So I think that there's a number of interesting things that I've seen. But again, not all leaders follow this. And I think that the critical thing in my mind is that the best leaders really role model this behavior.
Sahiba Singh from Spencer Stewart has an interesting insight around how we think about calendaring different activities.
Most leaders have been used to calendaring work. Now we see most people calendaring work and life to make sure that they can maintain, whether some people will call it work-life separation, some people will call it work-life assimilation, because the days have just continued to stretch on both sides and everybody has to be a lot more deliberate about how they're spending their time. One aspect is just, you know, me time and fitness. People are constantly interacting on Zoom calls through the day. And then they're going right without a commute in the middle. They're going right back to their families, kids, and sort of taking care of those aspects. So there is one leader that I know who is completely particular about calendaring his runs. Because for him, that's the only me time that he gets. It's the time he gets to think about his workday. So that's something that we see quite often. There's another client of ours, and she is absolutely clear that she has set aside her children's bedtime as non-negotiable. No meetings can get scheduled, no calls, etc. So I think we're all finding out different ways in which we work best. And it's also interesting that this also allows us to play to our preferences of how we like to work. So I'm not a morning person at all. And I love the fact that I can actually work my calendar in the day that I can start slightly later and work till later as well. So that's one thing that I see quite often.
In a way, remote work completely changes the role of an EA. It moves from keeping you productive at work to really taking complete ownership of your life, which includes work. This includes solving for exercise, family time, reflection time, breathing time between meetings, and much more.
Your EA is your best friend while you're doing this, because she's the one who... So, for example, you know, I have probably the most amazing EA in this world who will factor in 1 hour breaks on my calendar just so that I can go get some fresh air, get a coffee. You know, she will, if the calendar starts looking really bad, she will herself start kind of, you know, pushing things out a little bit.
Sahiba also makes an interesting point about the need for proactively solving for a support system in these times.
We've always spoken about leaders needing to have a support system. And somewhere when you're going to the office, you're meeting with your colleagues, your leadership teams, etc., that support system of opportunity to connect with people, talk to people, discuss things was almost organically built into the day. Now, given the situation where most people are actually more under stress than before, and in some ways disconnected from people in terms of just banging into them, you know, in the elevator or whatever, people have to be more, particularly leaders, have to be more deliberate about making sure that they have a support system that they can rely on for advice, to use as sounding boards. And that can take the form of their colleagues across the globe, that can take the form of coaches, mentors, that can take the form of sometimes family members that you discuss issues with. But you have to be a lot more deliberate about it than before.
Let's now get back to the conversation with Darlene DeRosa. In the book, you also refer to an article in Time magazine, Darlene, which talks about this disturbing trend, right? About 885,000 women left the workforce over a few months in 2020, while only 216,000 men exited during the same time period. However, in my conversations, another school of thought that exists is digital work is making it easier for flexible working, and therefore more women should possibly enter the workforce as a result. How do you see the dynamic from a gender perspective?
Absolutely. I mean, I think in general, there's a lot of research that has shown that throughout the pandemic, that it's been particularly hard on working moms. And again, I think this is a point in time due to the pandemic, because many people had no childcare because kids were home from school. You've got a global health crisis, and many women exited the workforce, as you said, based on the Time magazine article. I do think, however, that over time, the flexibility, which I think many employees now are really excited about, will lead to women reentering the workforce. I think the question that we have and others have talked about in their research is, how long is that going to take? What's that reentry going to look like? And so, you know, schools are opening back up. What is that going to look like over the next 6 months? And assuming, you know, the pandemic is really ending, then I think we'll be in a much better place. And I think our concern and what we put in the book is that this really could potentially set us back from a diversity perspective. So we're hopeful, because you're right, the technology, and there's a lot more flexibility out there that should make it in some ways easier for working mothers. But I think, you know, part of this was complicated by the fact that we had a global health crisis and limited childcare and schooling options.
Got it. Darlene, wrapping up, this podcast is titled Play to Potential. From your vantage point, given the research you've done in this and otherwise, what's your headline take on people to play to their potential in these times?
Yeah, first of all, I love that question. I think for me, and just based on the research we've done and talking to so many leaders during this global health crisis, the pandemic, I think, has caused so many people to rethink what is important to them. And you've seen that, you know, sort of people being more thoughtful about their role and really reconsidering the role of work and having more balance. And so I thought that that is actually great. This may cause a shift in how we think about work and what does work look like in the future. So for me, the other thing that I think is really important as you think about people playing to their full potential is that leaders should find their sense of purpose and really lead with that. Finding a role that leverages what motivates you and inspires you is going to really elevate your potential and make it easier for you to achieve whatever you're driven by. So looking at what motivates you, what excites you, that's a natural place for you to leverage your potential. And I think leaders have used this crisis to really re-examine what's important to them and find that sense of purpose that I think is particularly important to playing to one's potential.
Lovely. On that note, Darlene, pleasure talking to you at the podcast. Thank you so much for making the time.
Thank you, Deepak.
Thank you for listening. I hope you found the conversation purposeful. A couple of quick messages before we wrap up. If you're interested in receiving short 2-minute extracts of wisdom from the podcast, served up a couple of times a week, consider signing up by sending a WhatsApp message at +91 85914 52129. I repeat, the number is +91 85914 52129. Here we share short extracts across the various guests we've had at the podcast. Typically, it's one small extract in the middle of the week and one on a Saturday. Do also rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you consume the content. It might seem like a repetitive ask, but trust me, it makes a big difference in people discovering this podcast amidst a lot of noise out there, given the boom in the podcast supply in India and around the world in the last few months. It also helps us attract good quality speakers who look at some of these metrics for them to decide whether it's worth their time. To know more about what's in the podcast archives and the advisory work I do, you could just visit playtopotential.com. That's playtopotential.com. Thank you, and hope to have you tune into one of the subsequent conversations of the podcast. Bye now.